Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray and this is the Paul Foot Awards Mega Special Double Bill. We are very excitedly splitting the Paul Foot Awards coverage that we're doing into two brilliant episodes stuffed with fantastic facts and journalism for you this year. We're also doing something else that's slightly unusual. We are previewing the stories that have been shortlisted for the awards. As you listen to this, the awards are going to be happening tomorrow night and we will have a little supplementary mini episode later this week to tell you who won from the party. But now we're going to be talking to three of the brilliant journalists who've made it onto the shortlist for this year's awards, and they are about to introduce themselves now.
Hi, I'm Phil Coleman, chief reporter at NewsQuest Cumbria, based in Carlisle. My entry was an expose of a very distressing and disturbing incident, which involved police arresting a young man who had severe mental health problems. I had a very long legal battle to get the police video of that incident, and everything flowed from the success of that challenge ultimately.
My name's Hannah Summers. I'm a freelance journalist and I've written a series of stories for The Observer and The Guardian, and they're about transparency in the family courts and about how decisions are reached about the welfare of children in private law cases.
My name's Paul Morgan Bentley. I'm head of investigations at the Times newspaper, and I went undercover to expose how British Gas was breaking into the homes of vulnerable customers during the cost of living crisis and force-fitting expensive prepayment meters.
First, we're going to talk to Paul, who went undercover for his assignment. Paul, can you tell us a little bit about what that involved?
Yes, so I went undercover as one of these debt collectors, working on behalf of major energy companies and force-fitting prepayment meters. And at the time, during the winter that's just gone by, obviously the cost of living crisis and massive increases to energy costs, lots and lots more people were finding themselves in debt. And one of the tactics that is used by these energy companies is to force them onto prepay meters. And in kind of basic terms, the way they work is that if you top up, and if you don't have enough money on the meter, then it just cuts you off.
Right. And it wasn't British Gas directly you were working for. Is it right that it was a debt collector who they had contracted this work out to?
Yes, exactly. So I was working for Arvato, which was used by many of the major energy companies, not all of them.
Right.
But when I was there, actually, because of the cost of living crisis, a lot of the other companies had scaled back this kind of aggressive debt collection, but British Gas was ploughing on.
What happened when you went out on the road with your new colleagues?
Well, one of the crucial reasons for going undercover was there'd been quite a bit of reporting about prepayment meters, and the charities had been speaking very loudly about this and talking about how lots of people were being forced, essentially being disconnected because they were forced, you know, they run out of money. Essentially, they're being disconnected. They don't have any heating or light during the coldest months of the year. But each time the companies could always come back and say things like, this is a last resort, and it, you know, these are the, we never do it when there's very vulnerable people involved. And so there was this kind of these conflicting claims. You had these examples that were being reported, or the charities were talking about, where clearly vulnerable people were being targeted, but the companies could always come back and say, no, our assessments are very thorough. So I went undercover to see, you know, on the ground what's actually happening. And what happened was that we very much were being sent into vulnerable households to put them onto these prepayment meters. There's often a discussion about kind of can't pays and won't pays. And the industry will often talk about, well, right, these are people who are just refusing to pay their bills. What I saw on the ground was very, very different from that.
Can you describe a couple of the homes that you were sent into and the customers who were living there and being fitted forcibly with these prepayment meters?
Yes, yeah, so we were showing up with warrants because by that point it has to have gone through a court, right. And the court has to issue a warrant so that if they're not in, you can break in. So I was part of teams, usually of four or five men. There was a British Gas engineer with me. I was the shadowing a warrant officer, so two of us, also a locksmith, because if no one's there then they can break in, and a dog handler in case there's a dog there to get the dog under control. So kind of a big intimidating team showing up. One of the homes we were sent to with one of these warrants from British Gas, there was a mum there holding her four-week-old baby. Clearly, this idea that they were doing thorough checks and the courts were overseeing this and making sure that they weren't targeting vulnerable people. I mean, the idea that you show up at a new mother's home to put her onto one of these meters, and it was freezing. It was below freezing. It was the coldest weeks of the year. And she was there crying with her baby. Another of the homes I got sent to, there was a single father living with three young children. He wasn't in, so we broke in. And you could see the kind of the people I was working with, they were so desensitized to it. They were saying things like, oh, I love this bit. I love it when we break it and things like that. And you walked, we walked in, we spoke to a neighbor who confirmed that it was a single dad with three children. Walked in and, you know, I have a three-year-old son and I, you know, could recognize all the toys on the floor. It clearly there were very young children here. There were kind of toys all over the floor. In the kitchen when we walked through, there was a kind of Ventolin inhaler for a child. And yet we plowed on. The guy in his recording device said, no vulnerabilities here. And the British Gas engineer proceeded to switch them over to a prepay meter.
Just to go forward a little bit to the point at which this story was published, what happened next?
Well, we published the story and there was a bit of a kind of background, and I really do want to give credit as well to Dean Kirby from the I newspaper, who was also reporting on this issue. And he'd gone to courts and shown how they were being processed, these applications in bulk, you know, hundreds of cases in minutes, showing how little scrutiny there was on them. So there was already some kind of talk about it bubbling up, and Grant Shapps, the Energy Secretary, was talking about this. And while I was there actually undercover, he'd written to the companies asking them to stop doing this. And it was a really interesting moment where I was there and thinking, oh, is, you know, is, has the victory already happened before I've even published? But lo and behold, the next day I was sent out again to carry on doing it. So there was already some political will to do something in this area, but the companies were ignoring them. We published, and with all that that wave behind us, and then I think it was the really crucial thing of having the footage. You know, what I was talking about before, right. they couldn't deny that in these cases there were very vulnerable people involved. They couldn't say, oh no, we do all our checks. It was so obvious because we had the footage and the proof. So then very swiftly there was a huge reaction. The force fitting of prepayment meters was suspended, and months later now it remains suspended. Courts were ordered to stop listing the cases to make sure they weren't happening, and there were formal investigations launched by Ofgem, the energy regulator, and two parliamentary committees, and the government as well.
Thank you, Paul. And I'm sure that, as with so many of our stories, there may be further results coming in from that in due course. Now we move on to our second shortlistee, Phil Coleman. Phil, can you tell us about the incident that you managed to secure the police footage of?
This incident took place on June the 6th, 2021, in West Cumbria, on a remote country road, quite near to the town of Egremont. But pertinently, it wasn't a build-up area. There weren't lots of people around. This young man was walking alone with his dog quietly along the road when the police found him. So that's where it happened.
What happened after the police found him? Why were they looking for him in particular?
Well, there'd been a report that a young man had been seen in, and this is important, a distressed state, and he appeared to have a knife. Now, the police clearly and understandably were concerned that somebody might be in public with a knife. There's also a potential threat involved if that's the case. So they were keen to track him down, find out what's happened, and obviously detain him. So that was the starting point from the police's point of view. Shall I explain what happened next?
Yeah, I mean, how did that then lead to someone being repeatedly tased, screamed at? What happened in between those two points?
Well, there are two bits of evidence that I ultimately managed to get my hands on. The first was police body cam video, which I acquired through the courts, and it really was a lengthy, protracted, and complicated legal process. But to summarise what happened, this young man was originally charged with resisting police arrest and police assault, which, when you see the video and you hear the context, quite frankly, was absurd. However, I, through the courts, managed to get a redacted version of the video, and there were certain conditions attached to the release of that video. There was a second piece of body cam footage, and that showed the entirety of the incident from the very first point of contact between this young man to the point where the ambulance arrives to take him off to hospital to begin his 4 weeks in intensive care and the beginning of many, many months of recuperation. During the course of this 2 minutes, which ends with him lying semi-conscious on the ground, his head bleeding heavily and his skull fractured, during the course of that 2 minutes, police officers swore seven times, I counted. He was tasered between seven and ten times, some of those discharges being quite prolonged. And he, the young man himself, said four things. He twice said, "I haven't done out, I haven't done out." He once said, "Help." And he once said, "Oh God." So those were the only four statements that young man made during that distressing encounter.
Good grief. How did this story come to your attention in the first place?
It began, as many stories do, I'm sure we all had this experience, with a throwaway comment, which was made to me in the corridor of Carlisle Crown Court. Now, you know, I regularly go there to collect stories, and some of them are fairly straightforward, some of them are complicated. But this particular story was summarised to me by a lawyer. He first asked me a question: "Are you going into the case involving the young man who was tasered to within an inch of his life?" And of course that alerted my interest. So I went into the room, into the courtroom, and frustratingly, at this first hearing, he said he described what he'd seen in the police body cam video as unedifying. Red flag. He also said it ought to be looked at. And I don't think that was a reference to me and what I was subsequently going to do. However, crucially, he didn't play the video during the hearing.
Was the fact that it was dropped a barrier between you and accessing the actual footage and finding out what had gone on in this story?
Not of itself, because had the video been played at that point in court, I would then have been in a position to mount the legal challenge, which I mounted. However, it subsequently emerged, and, you know, I asked lots of questions, and I at this point knew what the video showed. I'll say no more than that. It subsequently emerged that the second charge, the resisting arrest charge, hadn't been dropped. So, fortuitously, the case was brought back to court, and fortuitously, it was put before a recorder who hadn't previous knowledge of the case. And on this occasion, the prosecutor, in order to explain why the charge should be dropped, played the video clip of the actual incident where this young man is injured. And, of course, I immediately jumped to my feet. I was pre-warned that this would happen, clearly. I jumped to my feet and I made an impromptu application for the release of that content, which, understandably, the recorder passed on to the presiding senior judge.
So it sounds as if the charges against the young man were dropped.
Indeed they were, yes.
Both of them. What about the police officers in this footage? Have any of them faced any sanction or investigation as a result of this?
Well, the story became increasingly complicated and, in a sense, political. Clearly the IOPC were involved, given the severity of this young man's injuries.
We should just say that's the Independent Office for Police Conduct.
Indeed, responsible for overseeing standards and looking into complaints. They said the use of force in this instance was reasonable, although they did concede that one of the officers involved could benefit from a period of reflection about his practice and use of force. So it was nothing to say here, move along. And they actually issued a statement, which was issued on the same day as the video footage was finally released to me. And at no point did this young man have a knife in his hands. And what I did, in order to illustrate this for the story, was I took a series, I think ultimately I had about 25, 30 stills showing this young man's hands. And at every point, they were empty, they were defensive, they were raised in the air, there was nothing to suggest that he had a knife. He was an aggressor.
Phil, I just want to pause you there because I want to bring in Hannah now. So, Hannah, your story is also, it's also one that's courtroom-based. It's also one that evolves on the release or retention of sensitive information. And it's one which is incredibly sensitive because it's about the family courts. Just for anyone who isn't really familiar with them, as I think lots of listeners may not be, can you describe what the family courts are, what their basic role is?
So the family courts cover disputes and difficulties that arise in almost every aspect of family life. So judges look at things such as adoption and child protection issues involving local authorities. But what I've been focused on in my reporting are private law cases concerning child contact arrangements. So where their parents have separated, or perhaps they were never in a relationship, have turned to the court because they are in dispute. Now, allegations of abuse are really common, and sometimes when serious allegations are made, a judge will order a fact-find hearing, and they'll make their findings based on the balance of probabilities. So it's up to the judge to make decisions about child welfare, and often they'll bring in people to help give advice or make recommendations.
Yes, and these experts are the people you've been looking into for the story that got you this nomination.
The experts that I've been focused on, a lot of them are specialised in what's known as parental alienation. And while the ultimate decision will be made by the judge, these experts can hold considerable power and influence. And where there's real concern regarding some of the cases I've heard about is where serious allegations have been made, including by children against their fathers. But instead of having a fact find, the court will bring in an expert who's diagnosed parental alienation. And on the back of that diagnosis, the resident mother can have her children removed before the court has had a chance to fully examine the original allegations.
Right. One parent turning the child against the other parent, and presumably in the hope of getting access to them.
What is problematic is that once alienation has been raised, everything can be seen through that lens, including the children's wishes and feelings. So the whole point is it's meant to be the children's best interests, and the children are meant to be represented in the court. But the issue with this alienation thing is then anything they say is just ignored.
Okay, and so the experts who've been appointed and, you know, who give testimony in court, the psychologists, you would expect that they are very well regulated, that they know exactly what they're talking about, and that they're subject to proper regulation. And you found that that is not the case. Is that right?
Well, there are tens of thousands of these cases going through the family court, and there is a data black hole. So it's hard to know exactly. I was hearing repeatedly from either advocates for those who are victims of domestic abuse, as well as those in the legal profession, that increasingly they were seeing experts who specialise in parental alienation, some of whom are regulated but problematic, but also experts who are not regulated. Now, there is guidance which says that experts ideally should be regulated by the Health and Care Professions Council, but it's down to the discretion of judges who they appoint. So the term psychologist is not a protected title. And you need to hold a protected title, such as forensic psychologist, in order to be regulated. So regulation is also an indication of the level of your qualifications.
Right. So you're suggesting that, well, and in fact, you've found people who are not regulated giving evidence as experts in the family courts about this matter of parental alienation.
Well, according to the Association of Clinical Psychologists, some of these experts are not properly qualified to make diagnoses and make recommendations about therapy. So the ACP UK put out quite a strong statement saying they were really concerned about some unregulated psychologists who were making recommendations for children to be removed from their mothers based on unsafe diagnoses. They framed that as a matter for public, concern of public protection. So you have court-appointed experts who are not regulated, who are financially incentivized to make findings of parental alienation because they charge hefty fees for their services. And in some cases, they may oversee or recommend highly expensive therapy.
Was it incredibly difficult to report this story because of the nature of the family courts, because of the amount of secrecy and the reporting restrictions, which are often there for very good reasons, of course, but which make reporting tricky?
Yeah, and I think what you have with this story is you have experts who aren't regulated, you have parental alienation, which has, you know, been found to be really controversial and problematic. And then you layer on top of that the fact that doors are closed to the public. And then also, which I think is really important to mention, is that parents are not allowed to talk about their cases, and they can be found to be in contempt of court if they talk about their cases, publish anything on social media, or talk to journalists. So there's a real lack of scrutiny. And if you think about genuine victims of a miscarriage of justice in the family court. To then be silenced on top of that is really disempowering.
One thing that we often talk about when we're talking to people who've been shortlisted for the Paul Foote Award, there are a few things that are in common between lots of the stories. One of them is patience. And it sounds like you've all had to have a great deal of patience in reporting all these. And the other is editorial support and having editors who you're working with and talking to who are on board and who understand the nature of these stories, and that they might take a long time to come to fruition. And, of course, sometimes that there are stories which never come to fruition, which don't quite get over the line at the end, despite there being lots of evidence. I just wonder if those have applied in your stories, the editorial support in particular, if anyone would like to weigh in on that or reply to anyone else.
Yeah, if I can come in on that. I think something that maybe my investigation and Phil's has in common was how the footage made all the difference. And in my case, there had been a lot of noise about prepayment meters, but the companies were able to get away with it. And the government, despite saying they were being strong on it, they weren't getting any results. And it was only really through the footage that change happened. And yes, I absolutely had support from editors who could see that even though whilst I was waiting to go undercover and the application took a while and other newspapers were starting to cover it, we held our nerve. And in the end, that was really crucial. And what I found really compelling about what Phil did as well is I've watched that footage, and it's the type of story that without that footage, you know, doesn't get much attention necessarily, or, you know, people can think to themselves, oh, you know, was he really carrying a knife? Were they really too aggressive? But you watch that footage and it is awful, and you really see the brutality of the police officers.
One of the challenges that every journalist faces is establishing versions of reality. And I was struck with my story in particular. There were versions of what happened presented by both the police and the IOPC, which curiously tallied. They both used the phrase, the individual became violent, or the man subsequently became violent, punching an officer in the face, punching him in the face. And our job as journalists is to challenge the official version of reality. And as Paul rightly said, the best and most irrefutable way to do that is to get direct evidence.
I was actually thinking of one difference that I've got with my story, and that is with both Paul and Phil's great scoops, especially like thinking of Paul's story. I watched the video of that first rather than reading it, and it was really compelling. And the footage there is obviously a really, really important key component, whereas with the work that I've been doing, it's been really challenging, especially as a freelancer trying to pitch these stories, because these are anonymized stories. We can't use names. We can't use pictures. There's nothing to illustrate them with. And people are scared to talk to journalists because, you know, they could be in contempt of court. So that's been one real challenge that I've faced. And in terms of the editorial support, obviously when you find an editor who does realise the importance of this and isn't put off by by things like, you know, not having named case studies, that's really valuable. But the other thing with the legal team is what I found was often judges were moving to block me from publication, and sometimes things just weren't clear. There aren't loads of people working in this area, and not all judges are used to having journalists in their court. And sometimes it would just be really unclear what or when I could publish. And I find that really stressful. So having good legal support was really important.
I think something that comes across, particularly with Hannah and Phil's, but also in a way with the prepayment meter scandal as well, is how opaque the court system can be, and how you have battles for really real basic information that the public should be entitled to. You know, the fact that that footage from Phil's story wasn't just released, the fact that Hannah has had to fight to tell these stories, and it hasn't even been clear that she could report on them, even though they're in a court. And similarly, I tried to get into some hearings to see the prepayment meter applications going through for warrants to break into people's homes. And the initial responses from the magistrates' courts were, oh no, these are just quick phone call hearings. Journalists aren't there. Mm. And it was like, well, we are entitled to be there. We live in a free society where it's crucial that journalists are at these hearings. And it was a real battle to try and get to that point. And so, you know, in each of these cases, I think it really shows just how hard you have to work to get access to that, to courts.
I just had a case just yesterday where I'd written to the court the night before. It was a county court. I'd written the night before to say, I'd really like to attend this hearing. Here's my press accreditation. Can you send me the link? Because I understand it's a remote hearing. Mm-hmm. And obviously that hearing was starting at 10 o'clock. It was 11, 12 o'clock before I heard back. I'd sent a couple of emails chasing up. Eventually, later that day, I got an email saying, the judge says that you're not permitted to attend because this court is not in one of the pilot areas. And just to explain, there is a move towards greater transparency and there is a reporting pilot going on in Cardiff, Carlisle and Leeds. And this was not one of these areas. But I was astounded that this judge didn't understand I was permitted to come into their courtroom to observe proceedings. And that kind of thing has happened to me really frequently.
Can I ask, this is really interesting because it seems to be something that happens a great deal in, I mean, lots of different areas of reporting. Is this, in your collective opinion, is it sclerosis? Is it deliberate secrecy? Is it underfunding of transparency? Or is it just a combination of everything?
Can I venture to comment that it's actually culture? There are tools designed to promote transparency and accountability in the court system. However, I think it's hard to escape the conclusion that the system and the practice is weighted towards non-disclosure very often. And the truth is that judges are the ultimate arbiters very often. And you have to ask the question, should there be a move more towards a duty to disclose than a duty to not disclose? I mean, generally speaking, I think an awful lot of courts across the country these days do not regularly see journalists. And that's absolutely true in the family courts for very obvious reasons. So I think there are occasions when it appears that in some spheres, courts are seen to be run for lawyers and not for the public. And, you know, we are there to represent every Tom, Dick and Harry who cannot get to the court because they're at work, they're busy doing something else, they don't have the opportunity. So more court reporting would be healthier for everybody.
And I think the move towards online hearings, which should be a positive thing, and allow more access, because remote access, like Hannah was saying, I think actually now it's being used as an excuse to exclude journalists because maybe they're not used to the requests, or, you know, there's that confusion. It's unbelievable right. that a judge would be confused between a journalist having access to report on a case versus a journalist like or Sky News filming a case. That's so obviously different. And the fact that a judge gets confused about that shows that in this technological move to having more remote hearings, there really has to be clearer directives for the courts about the fact that journalists are still entitled to be there. Absolutely.
And I was at an inquest last week where I went for one day. It's on over several weeks. And I know a lot of the journalists interested in that story had requested a remote link to attend. There was the facility there because we know that lawyers and people giving evidence were using it to participate in the process. But the coroner said that they would not provide that remote link to journalists. So there wasn't really a reason given.
Thank you so much to all of you for your contributions. Congratulations again on your shortlisting. And to you listening at home, the exciting news is that that's it for this episode, but there will be another episode in your feed right now with the other half of the shortlist. So go and check that out right now. That's it for now. See you next time, which is right now. Bye.